Welcome to Beyond the Sirens, our podcast series designed for paramedics who are called to urgent palliative and end-of-life care situations. The aim of the series is to start a journey together, raising awareness of the holistic and complex needs of end-of-life care.
We want to support you in helping patients and relatives make the best decisions for those who are dying and for those left behind.
During the series, we have drawn upon the wisdom of seasoned experts in this field. We are committed to equipping you with the tools and insights needed to make a meaningful difference to the lives of the patients and those that they love. I am Mary Buttle, a registered nurse with extensive experience in the fields of oncology and palliative and end-of-life care, and a wealth of experience in teaching and training in these areas.
And I'm Tessa Taylor, also a registered nurse. I, however, have been in palliative and end-of-life care for a very long time. So for those of you who've heard of Florence Nightingale, we were classmates. During this time, I have also been involved in teaching paramedics. Hi, everybody. Welcome to episode 4 of our podcast series, Beyond the Sirens. We will be discussing decision-making in the moment, covering natural dying versus cardiopulmonary resuscitation, advanced care plans, and what to do in the absence of any source of information, and how utilising the electronic palliative care coordination system may help. We are delighted to welcome Kieran Potts and Rob Whelan, paramedics working in the field but specialising in palliative and end-of-life care.
Hi Tess and Mary, great to be here.
Oh, thank you.
Hello, yes, and thank you from me as well. Really glad to be here today and really glad to be joining Rob and the listeners out there. Thank you.
We're delighted to have you here. So just reflecting back for a moment, if we made to our first episode in our podcast series and reflected on the experience that Dan shared with us. In that situation, there was no information available like DNA CPR, and a decision had to be made in that moment. I'm just wondering, Kieran and Rob, how would you suggest paramedics respond and react in a situation like Dan found himself in?
Listening to the story that Dan gave, I can relate to that personally. That was a situation that I was in when I first started as a paramedic about 11 years ago now. And it was exactly the same situation. And it's incredibly difficult when you've got all of that pressure on you on scene, where you as a paramedic, you want to do the right thing. You want to help your patient, but also the family pressure is very difficult to go against. You're going against what your training and your feelings are, that you have a poorly patient and they need to go to hospital.
Yeah,
but it is very different for palliative and end of life care. So with the what we need to look for, what would you look for, Kieran, as your first thing when you walk in?
So, yeah, I think reflecting as well what you said, Rob, that it is really challenging, it is really complex. This is something our staff are faced with like relatively frequently nowadays as well, given patients' wishes and personal wishes kind of evolving over the past few years, really, and the preference becoming much more prominent in terms of preferring to die at home. I think when we're entering that premise, we're attending very much with limited information, as Rob's alluded to. It's something I've come across in my practice, and, you know, reflecting on Rob's kind of early experiences, I think that's something every newly qualified paramedic probably fears and worries about nowadays, as Dan's reflected as well. But we're generally looking for any signs of any information. So we want to see, ideally, a document on scene that can support our decision making. And there's a variety that we'll go on to discuss, I'm sure. But ultimately, we're wanting to get an opinion from the family, from the patient, a preference. We want to understand to a great degree, really, what that person wants. So we'll be looking for any signs that we can identify their wish as quickly as possible. Right.
I think sometimes as well, that you're looking not only for documentation, but there's other things that you look for when you first walk in, isn't there? And I always think about frailty, about when you're first walking in, about that signs of frailty, signs of signs that somebody has a reduced function, So even as you turn up outside the door, you can see there's wheelchair access, perhaps. Uh-huh. As you walk in, you can see there's medications out, yeah. There's handrails that might be pointing you towards somebody who's frail. Oh. And then as you walk in, you can see maybe a hospital bed, syringe drivers, yeah. Those types of things can all point you towards this patient, maybe palliative or end of life care. And those are things as we walk in that before documentation is given. I think as well with you've talked about communication skills in one of the previous episodes. That is the number one way that you can find out about whether a patient is end of life or palliative care. And I think sometimes it is not as easy as we would like it to be. Yeah. There's so many different things going on, isn't there, Kieran? Sometimes.
Yeah, totally agree that I think we're entering a dynamic situation when we've not met that person or that family member before. It's very, very rare that we would come across the same person twice in our line of work.
Yeah.
We're expected, and I think we owe it to the family and the person to be making a rapid decision with them as quickly as possible. So I think a lot of it is that information, fact-finding, the communication, all that kind of side of the street kind of. It's like the end of bedogram that's discussed from hospital colleagues, that you're looking at everything that Rob describes and trying to rapidly interpret that to make a decision, or at least to kind of form an initial decision and an opinion of what we can offer to that family and that person.
So it certainly sounds as if one of your key things is gathering your information and you're picking up every cue you can. You're all eyes and all ears as you walk into that home for the very first time. And I'm just very aware that you haven't got that luxury of time, have you, to debate, to deliberate about what your plan of action is. It really has got to be a very, as we say, decision made in a moment.
The thing that I always come back to was something that Tess taught on a communication skills many, many years ago. And that was slowing the situation down when you first walk in. Yeah. And saying what you can see,
yeah.
With the relatives. So when you first walk in, they can be very, as I say, dynamic, very emotional situations, and you need to acknowledge that. You know, you can see that somebody is upset. You can see that they are that this is an emotional time, and that they're worried. Say that you can, you know. Exactly what you can see, acknowledge that, and that does slow the situation down. Yeah. And we talk about it being a very dynamic and a quick process, but the difference between us getting the correct information and rushing through can be a minute, 2 minutes,
yeah.
But that can make all the difference,
yeah.
In whether we make the right decision or the wrong decision for the patient.
Yeah.
And that's part of the information that you pick up, the first piece of information that you,
yeah.
you walk in. Just to add, these situations, you know, they're difficult for somebody who's worked here for 11 years, and that's not a long time. Kieran's 12 years now. There's people that have worked for 20 years or so, and these are still difficult.
Yes.
Situations, yeah. You're taking so much information from so many different sources,
yeah.
And for any newly qualified staff or staff that aren't confident, it will come. This, you know, the experience and the ability, it will come.
Right, because I was just thinking about if a paramedic has got this 999 call to go, I can imagine your adrenaline's flowing and you're hyper, if you like. And for a relative who maybe has never seen anybody die, how they might be feeling, their adrenaline's running, they're panicking. And I'm just thinking the two of you meeting together, I can see how that could create that you've got to act quickly here and now. and maybe not try, as you said, Rob, to slow things down. Because I can imagine how you're trying to respond to them as quickly as you can. And an unexperienced paramedic might think, that's it then, I'll do whatever they ask me to do. When that, you know, clearly is not the right thing.
I think the main thing for me that Rob kind of echoed there, that in a way we're trying to slow the situation down, but the temptation is that we've got a bag of medications in the ambulance, we've got, you know, numerous pieces of medical equipment, that we very quickly medicalise those situations by just being present, I think, which is a big worry. And sometimes the reason why we're there is difficult to determine. So a lot of that communication element that Rob's alluded to is really important. But ultimately, it's trying to establish very quickly why we're there and why that person needs our assistance. And it might be that there is a symptom we can manage or we can support. It might be that actually it is entirely appropriate that person wishes to go to hospital, and the family very much might reflect that and say, yeah, this is the right thing for this person because there is a palliative care emergency or there is something that we can support them with. So it's very difficult to balance that sometimes. But I think communication is certainly the cornerstone of practice. And I guess for colleagues that are either new to the situation because they're newly qualified, or new to the situation because this is something you might see once or twice a year, once or twice in a career potentially. I think sometimes it is just that element of knowing that they will be supported with the decision making, that we don't set out to do the wrong thing. I know there's a fear that we might make the wrong decision, but ultimately we're human beings trying to do a human thing, and by being there in that moment, but we are trying to do the right thing and trying to allow that person to have the death that they want. So that is very, very challenging, both emotionally and morally, I think. A good reflection there, Rob, when you mentioned communication skills.
I think you make a good point there, Kieran, about why are we there, and finding out exactly what it is that's changed. Because we don't know this patient at all. The family may have been living with that patient for a long, long time of deterioration, or it may be something very sudden. And we need to find out what it is that is concerning them. And that sounds very obvious and very easy. It's not an easy thing to find out exactly what it is. Are they more breathless? Are they more sleepy? Are they making audible noises? We know with secretions, they can be very, very distressing to hear. And as professionals, that's our chance to listen, to hear exactly what it is that's concerning them, the relatives or the patients, and put their mind at ease about what it is, or help them. And we haven't even got to documentation yet, have we? We haven't even walked in and asked for a document, and we've already almost found out exactly what it is that is going on. We'll find out whether there's a reversible cause already, whether it's potentially something that's been going on, or we've found out involvement from teams, because they probably would have told us the doctor's on their way, but we panicked, or the district nurses are going to be an hour until they get here and they're distressed. So we've found out loads already.
I think that's the value, isn't it, when we talk about in our communication skills about gathering before we give. So gather all that information by asking those open questions, by observing everything, and then taking that breath, as Tessa advocates, just to process everything before you start making those decisions. And I'm just wondering, Kieran, you mentioned a support that was out there for colleagues when you've got this uncertainty, when they've got these challenging decisions they've got to make in the moment. What does that support look like?
So I think it's quite varied dependent on where people work and what their kind of workplace is set up. And I think generally there's access to some form of decision-making support, regardless of which organisation people work for. Especially in our organisation, we've got 24/7 essentially top cover with a consultant level medic that can support decision making. And I think for staff to know that there's not a problem with picking the phone up and saying, I'm not sure what to do here. I think the fact that staff aren't sure what to do in a situation is almost strangely reassuring, that, you know, we're not just assuming that, yeah, everyone can do this and this is really easy to do. This isn't easy at all. And that's what we're talking about, that, you know, this is essentially a very, very difficult thing to do as a human being, but as a clinician too. So I think for us, we've got that access to that immediate top cover via a kind of a leadership structure that's been in place for a number of years. But we've also got the access outside of our organisation to the community teams, to, you know, 24-hour support in some areas for hospice-led support. And we've got quite a kind of a plethora of referral options to primary care as well that we can access. So I think it's just about understanding that a decision can be shared, it can be made with another person. Because once that information's gathered, that's really, really rich information. And if we don't know what to do with that information, then sometimes someone else may well be able to help with that.
Yeah, because that's when I was thinking about a newly qualified paramedic maybe going out and then there not being a DNA CPR in place, and then them knowing that that would be an inappropriate thing to do, but legally, how would they stand? So you saying about that support system, I'm guessing then they would or could contact some people in this support system, the local hospice or, as you said, your consultant. Would that be what they would do then?
I think certainly in my experience, you know, when we've looked at these incidents from kind of our leadership roles that me and Rob both hold, we've looked upon these incidents to review and identify learning. And we commonly find that staff do share decisions and they do contact, you know, advanced senior decision makers that can support the kind of the journey that everyone's on together, really. And I think there's that buy-in to say, I can see that you're in a difficult situation. Let's think together what we can do. I think looking at the incidents from a learning perspective, that's always really rich to see that staff have considered that and have considered whether they can share that decision to make sure that ultimately, whilst this is a complex and difficult decision, it feels like the right one for that person. I know me and Rob take numerous kind of clinical advice calls to support staff, and I think looking at end-of-life care and palliative care situations, they do form quite a bulk of the calls that we do take. So I know in your experiences as well, Rob, have you found very similar? I know we work in different areas of the kind of the clinical area that we cover. But I guess we've both taken very similar calls, I guess, when you look at the themes as such.
Yeah, I think so. And the documentation certainly can vary across areas, what types of documentation. We are lucky that we are starting to move towards similar looking documents across areas, which is good. Certainly for our service, we're moving to electronic patient records, which does definitely assist with your decision making. I think around your documentation, I think it's good to have a clear understanding of which ones are legally binding and which ones are not legally binding. Now, correct me if I'm wrong, Kieran. Your ADRT and any advanced directives are legally binding. They're done as a legal thing.
Yes.
With respect forms, DNA CPRs, emergency healthcare plans, they're not legally binding.
Yes, right.
And they're seen as more of a guide for your care, that actually this patient has previously discussed with with a healthcare professional and the family, and they don't feel that admission, they don't feel that resuscitation will be beneficial. I'm glad I got all of that correct.
Well done.
As soon as I give clinical advice.
Brownie points.
But there we go.
I think from my perspective as well, what I see is the legally binding nature of forms generally says that there's a set kind of content to be available upon that form, and it might kind of set out the fact that document will look relatively similar when you look at it as a clinician. So there's certain points that need to be considered for an advanced decision to refuse treatment. I think the one complexity for a non-legally binding document, which doesn't change the way in which we interpret the document at all in my eyes, the two documents that both give us rich information around that person's wishes, But I think what we do see, because there isn't a legally binding nature to some of, for instance, a DNA CPR or do not attempt cardiopulmonary resuscitation, I think across the region that we cover, we can start to see different colours to those documents, because there isn't kind of a pretext that says it must look like this and it must contain this. It's generally focused on resuscitation, but we might start to see slightly different borders, slightly different colours. So I think that does introduce some complexity. And as Rob said, we are starting to see some commonality across documents, really, when areas are starting to work together and the education that happens with that. But I guess it's one risk that we identify in our practice, that documents can start to vary. So it is a challenge. But absolute brownie points, Rob. I think that the principles you raised, totally agree. Always a challenge, though.
And I think when we talk about legal documents as well, it's lasting power of attorney. I'm just aware that you may come into a home and a relative may say they're the attorney for that their relative over health and welfare, and actually how that affects this decision. The patient may not have capacity because they're actively dying, but they're saying they're attorney. I'm just wondering, how would you respond to that?
I would say one of the most important things is to make sure that they differentiate between finance and health and well-being. That is something that is critical to understand, because sometimes people do only have one of them.
That's right.
And that in many ways, though, all the way through this, all with all of our practice, we are acting in the best interests of the patient.
Yes.
We're always, anything that we do as clinicians, as long as we're acting for the patient, we're doing the right thing. But sometimes knowing what is best for the patient is the difficult thing, isn't it? So if somebody has an LPA, a lasting power of attorney for health and welfare, for a relative who doesn't have capacity to consent, because that's another important distinction. If they do have capacity to consent, then the lasting power of attorney doesn't apply as such, because they do have capacity, they can make the decisions. But if they don't have capacity, then we have to still act in the patient's best interests. We can't make decisions that are totally inappropriate. Even if a relative with LPA can't demand a treatment, but they can refuse a treatment. So this is a game with your communication skills, and where you start to use your clinical judgment. And that can be something that's quite difficult if you don't have all of the information. But if you see somebody and you think that, really, you know, there's no DNA CPR, but actually you don't think that it would be beneficial for the patient, and you can justify why, for example, their terminal cancer and all treatment has stopped and they're being palliated, or if they are extremely frail and you in your clinical opinion don't believe that a resuscitation would be appropriate, you can make that decision as a clinician.
Right.
It's about being able to justify your decisions and being able to put that all together into your paperwork or your electronic PRF. And obviously you have to do it within the guidance of your employer, because we do have accountability to our employers as well as to the patients and to the HCPC. But that accountability, as long as you're doing it for the patient, that's the main thing.
Right, okay. So as long as then you can rationalise why you've done what you've done, you're covered, are you?
Yeah. The DNA CPR form is generally, because it's not legally binding, that is your piece of advice from a senior clinician to say, we don't think that resuscitation would be appropriate. However, I think we've seen other cases, haven't we, Kieran, where something is actually reversible, immediately reversible.
Yes.
And a DNA CPR isn't a do not resuscitate under any circumstances. If somebody's choked on a piece of steak, for example, or you know, or whatever, and they happen to have a DNA CPR, that might be something that's reversible. If they're not in the acute dying phase, we still have a responsibility to try and reverse that cause. But and that can cause some difficulty, can't it, Kieran? We've talked about this case previously.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think when there's that fear as well that staff members, when they do attend, and it's a do I, don't I provide care? And ultimately, I think one of the bigger fears is, you know, will I be in trouble for doing or not doing something? Yeah. And as Rob's alluded to, the biggest important factor in all of this is that decision justifiable? You know, can you immediately justify that decision to yourself, to your patient, to those around you? And these are decisions that sometimes have to be made very, very, very quickly. I know there's always the train of thought when you read the guidance of, well, if I do provide the care, then I can make a dynamic decision to withdraw that care appropriately as per the person's wishes. You know, there is a means of doing so. But then if we're not to provide that care immediately, I think there's very much a train of thought as well. I think it's probably a misunderstood train of thought as well across clinicians, that there's a panic and a risk there that if we don't deliver that care, we will be in trouble. But ultimately, as Rob's mentioned, I think if that decision is justifiable and there's good rationale, there's good reasoning, we've consulted with those immediately on scene with that person, and we can get a good, clear understanding. I think sometimes those decisions are sometimes made in absence of documentation being present as well, that we're having to rapidly interpret and make a decision. But ultimately, if the documentation is there to support us, then, you know, it's usable, it's accessible. But that kind of moves us to, you know, the digital age that we're coming into now, where there are a few concerns from staff that I've spoken to of accessing electronic records and how that would be immediately accessible, because they're used to seeing that paper copy with that person. So in these situations that Rob's just mentioned, where it is very dynamic and it is very, very rapid, I think where it's difficult to slow the situation down because we've got trained skills that we can deploy and use, I think that's when things do start to get really, really complex, which just goes to show that, you know, this isn't an easy area to practice within for paramedics and ambulance staff.
Yeah, it sounds really difficult. You know, I always think, oh, it's been tough being as a nurse, but I'll tell you what, I won't be a paramedic. And I always think to myself, and I think I've probably said this in the past, when the patient's family are panicking and you rock up at their door, they see that green uniform and they're filled with confidence, you know, and because I've been in that situation myself and I thought, oh, thank God they're here, you know, so already you have to sort of live up to that, don't you? Amazing. You do really well.
Yeah, absolutely. Well,
that's very kind. I think it is a privilege, and being able to attend to somebody in their ultimate time of need, and as staff reflect as well, when we read documentation together, when me and Rob kind of review for learning and any potential learning that staff can identify as well, I think it is quite poignant that we can see staff have spent time with people and have witnessed that person's death as that person's wanted to have their death. I think it is a very privileged position for us to be in as well.
Yeah, I completely agree, Kieran. You know, when we talk about end-of-life care, we are always reminded that we've only got one chance to get it right. And that's very much the same, isn't it, issue with paramedics. When you go into that home and someone is dying, you know, you're part of that process to get it right. You know, and if someone wants to die at home, how are you going to facilitate that? And it can be very challenging to make it happen. But if that's someone's last wishes, you know, we've all got responsibility to our best to enable that and to see that through. And, you know, we are also aware that that really helps with the grieving process. If someone has a good death, it can affect how people grieve, how their loved ones grieve going forward. So all these things are very valuable. They will make a difference.
So thank you. Rob and Kieran. That was a really interesting discussion, and I'm sitting here thinking I could go on all day about this. It's really interesting. Unfortunately, we don't have that privilege of that much time. So just really the key takeaways, and I'm just thinking, is that paramedics who are going into that uncertainty, there is a support system that they can use if they're unsure of which way to go. And also decisions that they make, so long as they're justifiable and can be rationalised out, then they should be okay.
And I think for me, if we had an ideal world to assist all of us, whatever profession we are, if we all had advanced care planning in place, if as healthcare professionals we have the courage to ask those questions, what's important, what do we want, and to have that information recorded and documented and accessible would really ease everyone's job, whatever position we are in the healthcare profession.
If you need help, ask for help. Never make decisions in isolation, especially if you're not confident. You'll never get into trouble for asking for help.
Is that your top tip then for surviving a shift? Ask for help.
Yes, I would say so. and good tea as well.
And good tea. We always ask our guests what their top tips are for surviving a shift. So, Rob, you've given us two there. Kieran, what would yours be?
I'm going to go with two then as well, because I'm going to start off with good coffee to counterbalance Rob's tea argument. So I think good coffee, but also just make the decisions you're comfortable with making as well. I think for staff out there in you know, a very challenging situation, it kind of dovetails with Rob's tip as well. But if there's a decision that is difficult, that actually, it's okay to step back and take some time to try and add a little bit more insight to that decision. But if that's difficult to do so, I'll revert to Rob's top tip as well. You know, good tea and always ask for help. I think that's always a powerful thing to do.
I think that's really important in terms of our own well-being. And longevity in our roles. Thank you for that. The other thing we want to ask you before you go is, what's in your lunchbox? We've asked all our guests this, so we're just wondering what your favourite thing in your lunchbox is.
A dual lion bar.
A dual?
Yeah. There's one for now, one for later. It will not be one for later.
Well, that's a new one. We've not had that one before. And that's very specific detail in the dual lion bar. Yeah. Thank you. Kieran.
So I'm going to go similar. I know we should kind of be promoting some healthy eating, but I think when you need a snack, you need a snack. And I think a Snickers for me, it has to be a Snickers. I can appreciate a good Lion bar, but I think a Snickers just hits the spot for me.
Okay. Is it funny how we always turn to chocolate?
It is. I just say there's other confectioneries available. Oh, well, thank you very much for your time. It's been a really valuable, interesting conversation, and we appreciate that you're very busy in your working life. So thank you for taking the time out and joining us today.
So, yeah, thank you so much for having us as well. Yeah, really do appreciate your time, and happy to help where we can. It's a really important subject. Thank you.
Thank you for listening. I hope you found it useful, the information we've given and our perspectives on it.
We hope you enjoyed the fourth of our six episodes. Please share your comments via the link in the bio, and we look forward to seeing you in episode number 5. We're hugely grateful to the North West Ambulance Service, EOLP and Vista Healthcare for their support in putting this podcast together.
So it's a goodbye from myself, it's a goodbye from Mary. Stay safe out there.